It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Maybe we should call the song Dr. Saxo Beat. I am just thrilled to be joined by one of the finest medical professors in the country, one of the leading researchers on medicine in the country, guy who is very much in demand always, but especially these days. Grateful that he has eked out a few minutes for us at this late hour. He is a professor of medicine at Stanford University, a research associate with the National Bureau of Economics Research, and a senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. Dr. Bhattacharya, it is always a treat to talk with you. Thank you for joining me on the radio.
Thanks for having me on, Frank.
So, Dr. Bhattacharya, let me begin with a question that I get just about every day or am exposed to just about every day. Let's say someone has had COVID, confirmed to have had COVID. They tested positive for COVID. They're over it. They recovered. They're fine. They're back in society. They're doing their thing. Is that someone that really needs to get vaccinated in order to have what we would consider full immunity?
So if someone gets COVID and recovers, there is an incredible amount of evidence in the scientific literature that suggests that they will be protected against reinfection. Reinfections can still happen, but they're relatively rare. And if they are reinfected, the reinfection will tend to be milder than the original infection, and in particular, to be protected against severe disease. It's similar to the kind of protection you get if you were to get vaccinated. For someone who's recovered from COVID, the protection is pretty complete. Now, vaccination can improve that protection to some extent, but it's much, much smaller improvement than someone who hasn't been previously infected. For those people, that vaccination is much, much, much more important.
So why has the CDC come out with the guidance saying that people who've had COVID and have recovered from it should still get vaccinated? Why, if their immunity is just as good as a vaccination?
I mean, the reasoning the CDC gives is literally that they don't know how long the protection lasts after you get COVID and recover from it. They don't know how long that immunity lasts, which is true. But I mean, that's also true for the vaccine.
Right.
It's in particular, you can see in a year, it's been a year and a half since COVID sort of emerged something on the order of 1% of documented cases have had reinfections. So the protection from natural immunity lasts, on the order of at least a year and a half. We don't, of course, with the vaccines have only been around 8 months, so we know more about natural immunity than we do about the vaccines in that sense.
One of the things that I hear a great deal from in terms of the vaccine skeptics in our audience is, look at all the people who've gotten the vaccine and then they've had one of these breakthrough cases of COVID. Yesterday, the news was about the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, who'd been vaccinated. He came down with COVID. How common are these breakthrough cases, and do these breakthrough cases in any way belie the effectiveness of the vaccine?
So you can think about the protection that you get from the vaccine, and actually from natural immunity, in two different dimensions. One is, does it protect you from getting infected at all? And it seems pretty clear now that after a few months, the vaccine no longer protects you against that kind of thing. You can get infected. You can sort of see this in the macro data in places like the UK, in Sweden, in Iceland, and places where lots and lots of people are vaccinated, yet you still see case outbreaks happening in the United States as well. So the vaccines, I think, after a few months, stop protecting you against all infections. However, and this is really important for everybody to know, the vaccines, even if they stop doing that, still protect you against severe disease. You're much less likely to die. You're much less likely to be hospitalized. You're much bad reactions from being infected if you are vaccinated. I mean, that's the reason why, for instance, I very strongly recommend vaccination, especially for older, vulnerable people.
Yeah, I had a caller yesterday. She was 66 years old. Her husband said he keeps urging her to get vaccinated, but she was reluctant to do so. My advice was that's exactly someone that should probably get vaccinated. And by the way, we'll try and squeeze in a few calls for Dr. Bhattacharya as well. 800-848-9222 if you want to ask a question to one of the finest medical researchers in the country. It's 800-848-WABC. Now, what about someone that's young and strong, 30 years old, no preconditions, not obese, just doesn't want to get the vaccine because they don't want to deal with a day's worth of side effects? Is that somebody that really needs to be vaccinated?
I mean, from a personal point of view, it's really, I think, up to the person. Like, if you're scared of COVID and you're 30 years old, and you have the vaccine protects even the 30-year-old. Now, the 30-year-old, just by dint of being 30, is much already at lower risk from bad outcomes from COVID than someone who's, say, 60. There's a 1,000-fold difference in the risk of mortality and severe disease from someone who's older versus someone who's younger. Just to give it a sense of the numbers, if you're older, or say over the age of 70, it's a 95% survival rate after COVID if you're not vaccinated. If you're under the age of 70, it's 99.95% survival after you're infected. That's without the vaccine. So a 30-year-old actually faces a relatively small mortality risk. The vaccine reduces it even further. But for someone who's nervous about COVID, I mean, I think it's a completely reasonable decision to get vaccinated if you're 30. Absolutely.
So at the start of the pandemic, a lot of the experts told us that COVID was spread asymptomatically, including by surface contact. Now, most people seem to believe that it's spread mostly by symptomatic people. Is that your interpretation? Is that correct? And if so, does that mean a mask mandate, like what New Jersey is doing and what other school districts are talking about doing, might be ineffective, or at least not as effective as quarantining people that are visibly sick?
Yeah, I mean, I think the symptomatic people are much more likely to be able to spread the disease than someone who's asymptomatic. Asymptomatic spread. Actually, I think there's sort of two classes of asymptomatic people. People who are just got the disease for a couple of days, maybe a few days after you are exposed and you're infected, you may have very few symptoms. You call pre-symptomatic, and then you later develop the symptoms. I think during that pre-symptomatic period, you can still spread the disease. But I think the primary mode is actually people who have some symptoms. So I think I agree with you. I think the mask mandates are not really all that effective. You see this in like lots of places that have had mask mandates that still have very, very considerable outbreaks. Like here in California, for instance, we've had lots of mask mandates. LA County has had a mask mandate for the last month and some, and yet the cases continue to rise. I don't see a lot of evidence. There certainly is no good randomized evidence that mask mandates do much at all in terms of reducing the spread of infection. I think the primary mode really is symptomatic. Although there's a lot of like back and forth in the medical literature still about that.
Yesterday was the first day here in New York City that restaurants are requiring proof of vaccination before you can be admitted. Is that a wise policy?
I don't think so. I mean, for a couple of reasons. One is vaccinated people, as we just said, can still spread the disease. Like, it doesn't protect you against all infection. And so vaccinated person, just because you're around vaccinated people doesn't mean necessarily that you're not going to get the disease. That's just not true. So it doesn't serve a public health purpose. The other is more of like a civil rights issue. If you're someone who's not vaccinated, well, who's not vaccinated? In the U.S., it actually often is minority population. I think I saw a statistic that said in New York City, 60% of minorities are not vaccinated. Do you really want to exclude 60% of minorities from access to normal, sort of normal life? It just doesn't seem right, especially since many people, the working class people, minorities, got infected and recovered because they were essential workers during the heart of the pandemic, and they are actually in, as we talked about for national immunity, low risk. So why would you discriminate against them? It makes no public health sense, and you're harming them. I think it's just a mistake, I think it's going to harm public health, trust in public health. I wish they would reverse that order.
Talk to me about herd immunity. We seem to hear a lot about reaching herd immunity early on, and ironically, now with the vaccine, which seems to make it firmly within grasp, we hear a little bit less about it. In your view, what is sort of the magic number before herd immunity is achieved between the combining people that have the vaccine or fully vaccinated and people who have had the virus and recovered from it?
I mean, I think part of the problem with that term is that people have a misconception that once herd immunity is reached, the disease is gone. That's not actually what herd immunity means. Herd immunity means that when one person gets infected, that person will infect one or fewer additional people. So the disease, it doesn't go away. It just continues to spread at a relatively low level. The herd immunity threshold changes with the season. Like in the winter, it's very clear that you need a much larger fraction immune for the disease to stop spreading. In other times, maybe lower. Like spring, I think is a low period for many places. So it's not a single number, and once it's reached, that doesn't mean the disease is gone. It just means that it sort of putzes along at a sort of a relatively low level. So I think it's a mistake to think we reach herd immunity and the disease is gone. Really what it means is we no longer get the epidemic spread that we got last year. And actually, in many ways, there's lots of good news, Frank. If you look at what's happened with the disease, we're seeing lots of cases in many places, but the number of deaths have not risen in proportion this year. You saw this dramatically in the UK, a huge rise in cases and almost, just a little tiny increase in deaths. In the US, actually, you're seeing similar things. Many, many places are getting case rises, but the deaths are not following the same way they did last year. That is a signal that we decoupled cases and deaths.
Wonderful.
And it's kind of, yeah, isn't that great news? I mean, I think we ought to be celebrating that to the sky. And there's lots of reasons for that. But the primary ones, we've protected the vulnerable with the vaccine and with other and of course, with natural immunity. So I think if the end point of this disease will be, in some sense, learn to live with it, it'll be much easier to learn to live with now that we have protected the vulnerable using the vaccine and other mechanisms.
Let me grab a couple of questions. I don't want to monopolize the opportunity to be able to talk with you. Jennifer is in Boston. She was trying to get on yesterday, but we never got to her. We'll start with her today. Hello, Jennifer.
Hey, Frank. Thank you for taking the call. Hello, doctor. I just was wondering two quick things. Things like ivermectin, Regeneron, that sort of thing, are those things readily available to someone who presents, as positive for COVID? Or does it depend on age?
Regeneron is in principle available for anyone who's over the age of 65, I think, and anyone whose BMI, body mass index, is 25 or more. So that should be, in most states, I think many states anyways, freely available. It's a big priority to be able to get folks who have COVID early in the disease and meet those criteria of Regeneron. Ivermectin is harder to get, and part because there's some randomized evidence from outside the United States, but not a ton of studies have been done in the U.S. So that's a little harder to get. And I think many public health officials wouldn't recommend it in the United States, although it's used in other countries.
Thank you, Jennifer. 800-848-9222. Dr. Bhattacharya, how effective, now we're dealing with the Delta variant, and there seem to be conflicting pieces of information about how effective the vaccines are against the Delta variant. How effective are the vaccines, and is one vaccine thought of as being more effective than the other two that are used in the United States as far as the Delta variant goes?
The Delta variant, it does not evade immunity from the vaccines, from protection against severe disease. If you have the vaccine and you've had the vaccine, you're fully vaccinated, and you're exposed to the Delta variant, you might still get sick. You might still get infected, but you're still protected against severe disease, death, hospitalization. So the Delta variant doesn't change that fact. which is, I think, the most important thing about the vaccines, not protection against all infection, but rather protection against severe disease. And Delta variant is still quite good against that.
Talking with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, a professor of medicine at Stanford, got a lengthy, lengthy resume. We couldn't list it in just a four-hour show. You were a signatory to the Great Barrington Declaration early on, opposing the lockdowns. And we saw a lot of places like New York basically ignore that guidance. One of the places which seemed to go along with your recommendation was Florida. And now a lot of media coverage has been covering the uptick in COVID cases in Florida. And while not overtly saying so, there's an implication that because Florida is so lax with things like vaccine mandates and mask mandates and not having any lockdowns, that you're more likely to see an uptick in cases. The same can be said of states like Alabama and other states like that. Given what we're seeing in Florida, are you rethinking that approach that you spelled out in that Great Barrington Declaration at all?
I am. I'm not, actually, and I'll tell you why. So if you look across the American South, in places that have mask mandates and more restrictions, and actually even as far as California, you're seeing rises in cases. The case rise is there's nothing we have in our technology to stop case rises. That's not what the Great Barrington Declaration is about. The Great Barrington Declaration is about protection of people who are vulnerable. And there, I think, again, across the American South, we've done a fantastic job by vaccinating the older population. I think something on the order of 85% of the, even in Florida especially, they vaccinated the old population very early. They've decoupled cases and deaths, which is really the goal, the end goal of to turn the disease from something quite deadly into something much, much more manageable. And I think we've kind of accomplished that. The case rises are going to happen everywhere. So this is a seasonal and regional disease, it will shift from, the American South to, the Northeast. It'll shift to the Midwest. The case rises will happen. But because we've done such a good job vaccinating the older population, the deaths won't follow. I actually think it's time to stop counting cases as a measure of how well we're done with the disease. We don't have a technology to stop the case. It's like trying to stop colds from spreading
right
now. What we should do is we should measure how well we're protecting the vulnerable. And I think we've had a really good start with the vaccines. And if we continue to spread up, discover better treatments and make them more widely available, we'll have even better results.
We've seen a lot of media coverage of ICUs filling up with unvaccinated children suffering from COVID. Is that accurate as far as you can tell, or is this blowing a handful of unfortunate children who may have preconditions out of order and blowing that up and out of proportion with what the general risk factor is for children?
Yeah, I think it's blown out of proportion. I think, I'll tell you one thing actually that has me worried for children is respiratory syncytial virus, RSV. It disappeared for much of last year and has come back in out of season in force. And partly because we had lockdowns, the kids weren't exposed to the normal viruses that they normally would have been exposed to last year, and it left them extremely vulnerable to those normal viruses like RSV. And so some of the unfortunate increase in ICU beds for use by kids is actually RSV, not COVID. COVID itself is actually quite mild in children. I mean, more children died in 2020 from the flu, even though there was a vaccine, even though the flu more or less disappeared in the latter half of last year, then died from COVID. That's just something we should thank our lucky stars about, that COVID doesn't harm kids so much. I hope that the RSV surge that we've been seeing sort of subsides soon, because it really has affected children. But I do think that normally RSV is manageable because kids get repeatedly exposed to it, and as a result, they build up immunity to it. I think what's happened is because of last year, the lockdowns actually, unlike COVID, which it didn't stop, it actually did stop the spread of RSV.
Let me take really a quick bad. Call from Nikki in Manhattan. Nikki, what's your question for Dr. Bhattacharya?
Hi, Frank. Hi, doctor. I have been so concerned about the people coming in over the border and the fact that there are no COVID protocols applied to these hundreds of thousands of people. And so I'm not surprised there's an uptick and an uptick and an uptick, you know, round and round we go, because they apparently are being transported to other states.
Dr. Bhattacharya, is that accurate? Is there a lack of COVID testing or vaccination for people that come across the southern border?
As far as I know, that's accurate. I'll tell you, though I'm not so concerned, and I'll tell you why. I mean, I think it's very difficult to stop the spread of this disease. The issue really to me is not can we stop the spread by border controls or whatnot. I'm just going to leave aside the issue of whether we should have an open or closed border.
It's a political issue, not a medical one. Right.
But, right. So to me, the medical issue is what should we do about the fact that if we have open borders, the disease might spread. I think there's not much we can do about the disease spread. I think we've learned from the last year and a half that we can, you know, burn the earth and nothing would happen. The disease continues. You know, do you know that 40% of white-tailed deer actually have COVID antibodies? Deer.
Wow.
I mean, the disease just it affects dogs, cats, you know, bats, apparently, you know, and certainly humans. It's very difficult to stop the spread of this disease. The key question to me is how do we protect the vulnerable? That's the people who get the most severe outcomes.
And it seems like vaccination is the easiest way to do it.
Yes, vaccination and then treatment, of course, if you get sick.
Any thoughts on the so-called long haulers, these people that suffered, that had COVID and are still suffering in some cases months later from respiratory issues?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. So, I think if you look at other viruses, like lots of people have had mono, you know, the kissing disease or whatever, where they can report like had months of like lethargy and fatigue, right? I mean, now that is not uncommon for some viruses. And it looks like COVID has, for a small fraction of people who get the disease, has some symptoms. I think the estimates I've seen is like measurable symptoms at 2-3 months is about 3% of the population that have COVID still have those kind of symptoms. On top of that, though, there's also the effects of anxiety from separation, from the separation and problems caused by lockdown. So you have this like conflation of both the long haul symptoms for a small minority of patients who get COVID, and also the symptoms that come from isolation and depression and other things from frankly fear. Like so imagine a large part of the population had been very, very scared about getting COVID. You get COVID and it just creates this, like, in addition to COVID itself, it creates this like sense of like panic around getting it. I actually saw a study that many long haul COVID patients, when they got the vaccine, many of the long haul symptoms went away. I think those are very real things that we need to think about and manage properly. First, by reducing the fear about the disease, because there's much less reason to fear it now than it once was. And the other by taking seriously the symptoms for the people who actually continue to have them and doing good research on trying to manage them.
I could talk with you all day, but we're just about out of time. I have two final questions that I want to ask you about. Every night, it seems like I get a caller who heard on the internet or heard from a friend of theirs that the way to treat COVID or the way to treat or prevent COVID is from vitamin C, or if it's from this or that. Are there any diets or mineral supplements that have been at least experimentally proven to reduce COVID symptoms or prevent infection to begin with?
I think there's good evidence for vitamin D, like really good evidence that vitamin D deficiency leads to worse COVID outcomes if you get sick. And I think even some evidence that it might help prevent. So if you are low on vitamin D, go out for walks in the sunlight, take vitamin D supplements. Even if you're not, actually walking in the sunlight is always a good thing, I think. I think there's some evidence for zinc. Also, it's not quite as good as the evidence for vitamin D, but it doesn't hurt to take a zinc supplement if you're so inclined.
Final question, sir. And again, I appreciate you staying up late and being so generous with your time when you're as in demand as you are. And I hope we can do this again soon, maybe in a week or two. But if you're pregnant, if you're with child, should you get the vaccine or should you not? CDC says you should. Do you have a view?
I mean, I'm not convinced by the safety evidence on that. I'm a little more conservative than the CDC on this. Pregnant women are not, they tend to be young, of course, just by definition. And so they also are protected against the severe outcomes from COVID, just generally. So the benefits of the vaccine are lower. And I don't know, I want to see better safety data before I'm convinced that that's a good idea. I can understand if someone might make a different call than that, on it, based on the same evidence. But I personally, if my wife were pregnant, I'd want better safety evidence before I'd recommend the vaccine.
Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, thank you so much for the time this evening, and I hope we can do this again soon.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Talk with you.